Chapter 13.
"They're total whores," Ange said, spitting the word out. "In fact, that's an insult to hard-working whores everywhere. They're profiteers."
We were looking at a stack of newspapers we'd picked up and brought to the cafe. They all contained reporting on the party in Dolores Park, and to a one, they made it sound like a drunken, druggy orgy of kids who'd attacked the cops. USA Today described the cost of the riot and included the cost of washing away the pepper spray residue from the gas bombing, the rash of asthma attacks that clogged the city's emergency rooms, and the cost of processing the 800 arrested rioters. No one was telling our side. "Well, the X-Net got it right anyway," I said. I'd saved a bunch of the blogs and videos and photo streams to my phone, and I showed them to her. They were first-hand accounts from people who'd been gassed and beaten up. The video showed us all dancing, having fun, showed the peaceful political speeches and the chant of "Take It Back," and Trudy Due talking about us being the only generation that could believe in fighting for our freedoms. "We need to make people know about this," she said.
"Yeah," I said glumly. "That's a nice theory."
"Well, why do you think the press doesn't ever publish our side?"
"You said it. They're whores."
"Yeah, but whores do it for the money. They could sell more papers and commercials if they had a controversy. All they have now is a crime. Controversy is much bigger."
"Okay, point taken. So why don't they do it?" "Well, reporters can barely search regular blogs, let alone keep track of the X-Net. It's not as if that's a real adult-friendly place to be."
"Yeah," she said. "Well, we can fix that, right?"
"Huh?"
"Write it all up. Put it in one place with all the links. A single place where you can go that's intended for the press to find it and get the whole picture. Link it to the how-tos for X-Net. Internet users can get to the X-Net, provided they don't care about the DHS finding out what they've been surfing."
"You think it'll work?"
"Well, even if it doesn't, it's something positive to do."
"Why would they listen to us anyway?"
"Who wouldn't listen to Mikey?"
I put down my coffee. I picked up my phone and slipped it into my pocket. I stood up, turned on my heel, and walked out of the cafe. I picked a direction at random and kept going. My face felt tight, the blood gone into my stomach, which churned.
"They know who you are," I thought. "They know who Mikey is." That was it. If Ange had figured it out, the DHS had too. I was doomed. I had known that since they let me go from the DHS truck, that someday they'd come and arrest me and put me away forever, send me to wherever Daryl had gone. It was all over. She nearly tackled me as I reached Market Street. She was out of breath and looked furious. "What the hell is your problem, mister?"
I shook her off and kept walking. It was all over. She grabbed me again.
"Stop it, Marcus. You're scaring me. Come on, talk to me."
I stopped and looked at her. She blurred before my eyes. I couldn't focus on anything. I had a mad desire to jump into the path of a muni trolley as it tore past us down the middle of the road. Better to die than to go back.
"Marcus!"
She did something I'd only seen people do in the movies. She slapped me, a hard crack across the face.
"Talk to me, damn it!"
I looked at her and put my hand to my face, which was stinging hard. "No one is supposed to know who I am," I said. "I can't put it any more simply. If you know, it's all over. Once other people know, it's all over."
"Oh, God, I'm sorry. Look, I only know because, well, because I blackmailed Holu. After the party, I stalked you a little, trying to figure out if you were the nice guy you seemed to be or a secret axe murderer. I've known Holu for a long time, and when I asked him about you, he gushed like you were the second coming or something. But I could hear that there was something he wasn't telling me. I've known Holu for a long time. He dated my sister at computer camp when he was a kid. I have some really good dirt on him. I told him I'd go public with it if he didn't tell me."
"So he told you?"
"No," she said.
He told me to go to hell. Then I told him something about me, something I'd never told anyone else.
What? She looked at me, looked around, looked back at me.
Okay, I won't swear you to secrecy because what's the point? Either I can trust you or I can't.
She broke off.
Last year, I stole the standardized tests and published them on the net. It was just a lark. I happened to be walking past the principal's office and I saw them in his safe, and the door was hanging open. I ducked into his office. There were 6 sets of copies, and I just put one into my bag and took off again. When I got home, I scanned them all and put them up on a pirate party server in Denmark.
That was you? I said.
She blushed. Yeah.
Holy crap! I said. It had been huge news. The Board of Education said that its No Child Left Behind tests had cost tens of millions of dollars to produce, and that they'd have to spend it all over again now that they'd had the leak. They called it edu-terrorism. The news had speculated endlessly about the political motivations of the leaker, wondering if it was a teacher's protest, or a student, or a thief, or a disgruntled government contractor.
That was you?
It was me, she said.
And you told Holu this?
Because I wanted him to be sure that I would keep the secret. If he knew my secret, then he'd have something he could use to put me in jail if I opened my trap. Give a little, get a little. Quid pro quo, like in Silence of the Lambs.
And he told you?
No, she said. He didn't.
But
then I told him how into you I was. How I was planning to totally make an idiot of myself and throw myself at you. Then he told me.
I couldn't think of anything to say then. I looked down at my toes. She grabbed my hands and squeezed them.
I'm sorry I squeezed it out of him. It was your decision to tell me, if you were going to tell me at all. I had no business.
No, I said. Now that I knew how she'd found out, I was starting to calm down. No, it's good you know. You.
Me,
she said.
Lil' old me.
Okay, I can live with this. But there's one other thing.
What?
There's no way to say this without sounding like a jerk, so I'll just say it. People who date each other, or whatever it is we're doing now, they split up. When they split up, they get angry at each other, sometimes even hate each other. It's really cold to think about that happening between us, but, you know, we've got to think about it.
I solemnly promise that there is nothing you could ever do to me that would cause me to betray your secret. Nothing. Screw a dozen cheerleaders in my bed while my mother watches. Make me listen to Britney Spears. Rip off my laptop, smash it with hammers, and soak it in seawater. I promise. Nothing. Ever.
I whooshed out some air. I said.
Now would be a good time to kiss me,
she said, and turned her face up.
Mikey's next big project on the X-Net was putting together the ultimate roundup of reports of the Don't Trust party at Dolores Park. I put together the biggest, most badass site I could, with sections showing the action by location, by time, by category, police violence, dancing, aftermath, singing. I uploaded the whole concert. It was pretty much all I worked on for the rest of the night. And the next night. And the next. My mailbox overflowed with suggestions from people. They sent me dumps off their phones and their pocket cameras. Then I got an email from a name I recognized. Dr. Evil, 3 E's, one of the prime maintainers of Paranoid Linux.
Mikey, I have been watching your XNet experiment with great interest. Here in Germany, we have much experience with what happens with a government that gets out of control. One thing you should know is that every camera has a unique noise signature that can be used to later connect a picture with the camera. That means that the photos you're republishing on your site could potentially be used to identify the photographers, should they later be picked up for something else. Luckily, it's not hard to strip out the signatures, if you care to. There's a utility on the Paranoid Linux distro you're using that does this. It's called Photonymous, and you'll find it in /usr/bin. Just read the man pages for documentation. It's simple, though. Good luck with what you're doing. Don't get caught. Stay free. Stay paranoid. Dr. Evil. I de-fingerprintized all the photos I'd posted and put them back up, along with a note explaining what Dr. Evil had told me, warning everyone else to do the same. We all had the same basic paranoid Xbox install, so we could all anonymize our pictures. There wasn't anything I could do about the photos that had already been downloaded and cached, but from now on, we'd be smarter. That was all the thought I gave the matter that night, until I got down to breakfast the next morning, and Mom had the radio on, playing the NPR morning news. Arabic news agency Al Jazeera is running pictures, video, and first-hand accounts of last weekend's youth ride in Mission Dolores Park, the announcer said as I was drinking a glass of orange juice. I managed not to spray it across the room, but I did choke a little. Al Jazeera reporters claimed that these accounts were published on the so-called XNet, a clandestine network used by students and Al-Qaeda sympathizers in the Bay Area. This network's existence has long been rumored, but today marks its first mainstream mention. Mom shook her head. "Just what we need," she said. "As if the police weren't bad enough. Kids running around, pretending to be guerrillas and giving them the excuse to really crack down." The XNet weblogs have carried hundreds of reports and multimedia files from young people who attended the riot and allege that they were gathered peacefully until the police attacked them. Here is one of those accounts. "All we were doing was dancing. I brought my little brother. Bands played and we talked about freedom, about how we were losing it to these jerks who say they hate terrorists but who attack us, though we're not terrorists. We're Americans. I think they hate freedom, not us. We danced and the bands played and it was all fun and good. And then the cops started shouting at us to disperse. We all shouted, 'Take it back,' meaning take America back. The cops gassed us with pepper spray. My little brother is 12. He missed 3 days of school. My stupid parents say it was my fault. How about the police? We pay them and they're supposed to protect us, but they gassed us for no good reason. Gassed us like they gas enemy soldiers." Similar accounts, including audio and video, can be found on Al Jazeera's website and on the XNet. You can find directions for accessing this XNet on NPR's homepage. Dad came down. "Do you use the XNet?" he said. He looked intensely at my face. I felt myself squirm. "It's for video games," I said. "That's what most people use it for. It's just a wireless network. It's what everyone did with those free Xboxes they gave away last year." He glowered at me. "Games? Marcus, you don't realize it, but you're providing cover for people who plan on attacking and destroying this country. I don't want to see you using this XNet. Not anymore. Do I make myself clear?" I wanted to argue. Hell, I wanted to shake him by the shoulders. But I didn't. I looked away. I said, "Sure, Dad." I went to school. At first, I was relieved when I discovered that they weren't going to leave Mr. Benson in charge of my social studies class. But the woman they found to replace him was my worst nightmare. She was young, just about 28 or 29, and pretty, in a wholesome kind of way. She was blonde and spoke with a soft southern accent when she introduced herself to us as Mrs. Anderson. That set off alarm bells right away. I didn't know any women under the age of 60 that called themselves Mrs. But I was prepared to overlook it. She was young, pretty, she sounded nice. She would be okay. She wasn't okay.
Under what circumstances should the federal government be prepared to suspend the Bill of Rights?
She said, turning to the blackboard and writing down a row of numbers, 1 through 10.
Never, I said, not waiting to be called on. This was easy.
Constitutional rights are absolute.
That's not a very sophisticated view.
She looked at her seating plan.
Marcus, for example, say a policeman conducts an improper search. He goes beyond the stuff specified in his warrant. He discovers compelling evidence that a bad guy killed your father. It's the only evidence that exists. Should the bad guy go free?
I knew the answer to this, but I couldn't really explain it.
Yes, I said finally, but the police shouldn't conduct improper searches.
Wrong, she said.
The proper response to police misconduct is disciplinary action against the police, not punishing all of society for one cop's mistake.
She wrote criminal guilt under point 1 on the board.
Other ways in which the Bill of Rights can be superseded?
Charles put his hand up. Shouting fire in a crowded theater?
Very good, she consulted the seating plan. Charles? There are many instances in which the First Amendment is not absolute. Let's list some more of those.
Charles put his hand up again. Endangering a law enforcement officer.
Yes, disclosing the identity of an undercover policeman or intelligence officer. Very good.
She wrote it down.
Others?
National security, Charles said, not waiting for her to call on him again. Libel, obscenity, corruption of minors, child porn, bomb-making recipes. Mrs. Anderson wrote these down fast, but stopped at child porn.
Child porn is just a form of obscenity.
I was feeling sick. This was not what I'd learned or believed about my country. I put my hand up.
Yes, Marcus?
I don't get it. You're making it sound like the Bill of Rights is optional. It's the Constitution. We're supposed to follow it, absolutely.
That's a common oversimplification, she said, giving me a fake smile. But the fact of the matter is that the framers of the Constitution intended it to be a living document that was revised over time. They understood that the Republic wouldn't be able to last forever if the government of the day couldn't govern according to the needs of the day. They never intended the Constitution to be looked on like religious doctrine. After all, they came here fleeing religious doctrine.
I shook my head. What?
No.
They were merchants and artisans who were loyal to the king until he instituted policies that were against their interests and enforced them brutally. The religious refugees were way earlier.
Some of the framers were descended from religious refugees, she said.
And the Bill of Rights isn't supposed to be something you pick and choose from. What the framers hated was tyranny. That's what the Bill of Rights is supposed to prevent. They were a revolutionary army, and they wanted a set of principles that everyone could agree to. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The right of people to throw off their oppressors.
Yes, yes, she said, waving at me. They believed in the right of people to get rid of their kings. But
Charles was grinning, and when she said that, he smiled even wider. They set out the Bill of Rights because they thought that having absolute rights was better than the risk that someone would take them away. Like the First Amendment. It's supposed to protect us by preventing the government from creating two kinds of speech, allowed speech and criminal speech. They didn't want to face the risk that some jerk would decide that the things that he found unpleasant were illegal. She turned and wrote, "Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness" on the board.
We're getting a little ahead of the lesson, but you seem like an advanced group.
The others laughed at this, nervously.
The role of government is to secure for citizens the rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. In that order. It's like a filter. If the government wants to do something that makes us a little unhappy or takes away some of our liberty, it's okay, providing they're doing it to save our lives. That's why the cops can lock you up if they think you're a danger to yourself or others. you lose your liberty and happiness to protect life. If you've got life, you might get liberty and happiness later.
Some of the others had their hands up.
Doesn't that mean that they can do anything they want if they say it's to stop someone from hurting us in the future?
Yeah,
another kid said.
This sounds like you're saying that national security is more important than the Constitution.
I was so proud of my fellow students then. I said, how can you protect freedom by suspending the Bill of Rights? She shook her head at us like we were being very stupid.
The revolutionary founding fathers shot traitors and spies. They didn't believe in absolute freedom, not when it threatened the Republic. Now you take these X-Net people.
I tried hard not to stiffen.
These so-called jammers who were on the news this morning. After this city was attacked by people who've declared war on this country, they set about sabotaging the security measures set up to catch the bad guys and prevent them from doing it again. They did this by endangering and inconveniencing their fellow citizens.
They did it to show that our rights were being taken away in the name of protecting them, I said.
Okay, I shouted. God, she had me so steamed.
They did it because the government was treating everyone like a suspected terrorist.
So they wanted to prove that they shouldn't be treated like terrorists? Charles shouted back.
So they acted like terrorists? So they committed terrorism?
I boiled.
Oh, for Christ's sake! Committed terrorism? They showed that universal surveillance was more dangerous than terrorism. Look at what happened in the park last weekend. Those people were dancing and listening to music. How is that terrorism?
The teacher crossed the room and stood before me, looming over me until I shut up.
Marcus, you seem to think that nothing has changed in this country. You need to understand that the bombing of the Bay Bridge changed everything. Thousands of our friends and relatives lie dead at the bottom of the bay. This is a time for national unity in the face of the violent insult our country has suffered.
I stood up. I'd had enough of this everything has changed crapola.
National unity? The whole point of America is that we're the country where dissent is welcome. We're a country of dissidents and fighters and university dropouts and free speech people.
I thought of Ms. Galvez's last lesson and the thousands of Berkeley students who'd surrounded the police van when they tried to arrest a guy for distributing civil rights literature. No one tried to stop those trucks when they drove away with all the people who'd been dancing in the park. I didn't try. I was running away. Maybe everything had changed.
I believe you know where Mr. Benson's office is, she said to me. You are to present yourself to him immediately. I will not have my classes disrupted by disrespectful behavior. For someone who claims to love freedom of speech, you're certainly willing to shout down anyone who disagrees with you.
I picked up my school book and my bag and stormed out. The door had a gas lift, so it was impossible to slam, or I would have slammed it. I went fast to Mr. Benson's office. Cameras filmed me as I went. My gait was recorded. The ARFIDs and my student ID broadcast my identity to censors in the hallway. It was like being in jail.
Close the door, Marcus,
Mr. Benson said. He turned his screen around so that I could see the video feed from the social studies classroom. He'd been watching.
What do you have to say for yourself?
That wasn't teaching. It was propaganda. She told us that the Constitution didn't matter.
No. She said it wasn't religious doctrine. And you attacked her like some kind of fundamentalist proving her point. Marcus, you of all people should understand that everything changed when the bridge was bombed. Your friend Daryl...
Don't you say a goddamn word about him,
I said, the anger bubbling over.
You're not fit to talk about him. Yeah, I understand that everything's different now. We used to be a free country. Now we're not.
Marcus, do you know what zero tolerance means?
I backed down. He could expel me for threatening behavior. It was supposed to be used against gang kids who tried to intimidate their teachers. But of course, he wouldn't have any compunction about using it on me.
Yes, I said. I know what it means.
I think you owe me an apology, he said.
I looked at him. He was barely suppressing his sadistic smile. A part of me wanted to grovel. It wanted to beg for his forgiveness for all my shame. I tamped that part down and decided that I would rather get kicked out than apologize. Governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. I remembered it, word for word. He shook his head.
Remembering things isn't the same as understanding them, Sonny.
He bent over his computer and made some clicks. His printer purred. He handed me a sheet of warm board letterhead that said I'd been suspended for 2 weeks.
I'll email your parents now. If you're still on school property in 30 minutes, you'll be arrested for trespassing.
I looked at him.
You don't want to declare war on me and my own school, he said. You can't win that war. Go!
I left. Chapter 14. The X-Net wasn't much fun in the middle of the school day, when all the people who used it were in school. I had the piece of paper folded in the back pocket of my jeans, and I threw it on the kitchen table when I got home. I sat down in the living room and switched on the TV. I never watched it, but I knew that my parents did. The TV and the radio and the newspapers were where they got all their ideas about the world. The news was terrible. There were so many reasons to be scared. American soldiers were dying all over the world. Not just soldiers, either. National Guardsmen, who thought they were signing up to help rescue people from hurricanes, stationed overseas for years and years of a long and endless war. I flipped around the 24-hour news networks, one after another. A parade of officials telling us why we should be scared. A parade of photos of bombs going off around the world. I kept flipping and found myself looking at a familiar face. It was the guy who had come into the truck and spoken to Severe Haircut Lady when I was chained up in the back, wearing a military uniform. The caption identified him as Major General Graham Sutherland, Regional Commander, DHS. I hold in my hands actual literature on offer at the so-called concert in Dolores Park last weekend. He held up a stack of pamphlets. There'd been lots of pamphleteers there, I remembered. Wherever you got a group of people in San Francisco, you got pamphlets. I want you to look at these for a moment. Let me read you their titles. Without the Consent of the Governed, A Citizen's Guide to Overthrowing the State. Here's one. Did the September 11th bombings really happen? And another. How to use their security against them. This literature shows us the true purpose of the illegal gathering on Saturday night. This wasn't merely an unsafe gathering of thousands of people without proper precaution or even toilets. It was a recruiting rally for the enemy. It was an attempt to corrupt children into embracing the idea that America shouldn't protect herself. Take this slogan, "Don't trust anyone over 25. What better way to ensure that no considered, balanced adult discussion is ever injected into your pro-terrorist message than to exclude adults, limiting your group to impressionable young people? When police came on the scene, they found a recruitment rally for America's enemies in progress. The gathering had already disrupted the nights of hundreds of residents in the area, none of whom had been consulted in the planning of this all-night rave party. They ordered these people to disperse. That much is visible on all the video. And when the revelers turned to attack them, egged on by the musicians on stage,
the police subdued them using non-lethal crowd control techniques. The arrestees were ringleaders and provocateurs who had led the thousands of impressionistic young people there to charge the police lines. 827 of them were taken into custody. Many of these people had prior offenses. More than 100 of them had outstanding warrants. They are still in custody. Ladies and gentlemen, America is fighting a war on many fronts, but nowhere is she in more grave danger than she is here, at home. Whether we are being attacked by terrorists or those who sympathize with them. A reporter held up a hand and said, "General Sutherland, surely you're not saying that these children were terrorist sympathizers for attending a party in the park?" "Of course not. But when young people are brought under the influence of our country's enemies, it's easy for them to end up over their heads. Terrorists would love to recruit a fifth column to fight the war on the home front for them. If these were my children, I'd be gravely concerned." Another reporter chimed in. "Surely this is just an open-air concert, General. They were hardly drilling with rifles." The general produced a stack of photos and began to hold them up. "These are pictures that officers took with infrared cameras before moving in." He held them next to his face and paged through them one at a time. They showed people dancing really rough, some people getting crushed or stepped on. Then they moved into sex stuff by the trees, a girl with three guys, two guys necking together. There were children as young as 10 years old at this event. A deadly cocktail of drugs, propaganda, and music resulted in dozens of injuries. It's a wonder there weren't any deaths. I switched the TV off. They made it look like it had been a riot. If my parents thought I'd been there, they'd have strapped me to my bed for a month and only let me out afterward wearing a tracking collar. Speaking of which, they were going to be pissed when they found out I'd been suspended. They didn't take it well. Dad wanted to ground me, but Mom and I talked him out of it. "You know that vice principal has had it in for Marcus for years," Mom said. "The last time we met him, you cursed him for an hour afterward. I think the word asshole was mentioned repeatedly." Dad shook his head. "Disrupting a class to argue against the Department of Homeland Security?" "It's a social studies class, Dad," I said. I was beyond caring anymore, but I felt like if Mom was going to stick up for me, I should help her out. "We were talking about the DHS. Isn't debate supposed to be healthy?" "Look, son," he said. He'd taken to calling me son a lot. It made me feel like he'd stopped thinking of me as a person and switched to thinking of me as a kind of half-formed larva that needed to be guided out of adolescence. I hated it. "You're going to have to learn to live with the fact that we live in a different world today. You have every right to speak your mind, of course, but you have to be prepared for the consequences of doing so. You have to face the fact that there are people who are hurting, who aren't going to want to argue the finer points of constitutional law when their lives are at stake. We're in a lifeboat now, and once you're in the lifeboat, no one wants to hear about how mean the captain is being." I barely restrained myself from rolling my eyes. "I've been assigned 2 weeks of independent study, writing one paper for each of my subjects, using the city for my background. A history paper, a social studies paper, an English paper, a physics paper. It beats sitting around at home watching television." Dad looked hard at me, like he suspected I was up to something, then nodded. I said goodnight to them and went up to my room. I fired up my Xbox and opened a word processor and started to brainstorm ideas for my papers. Why not? It really was better than sitting around at home. I ended up IMing with Ange for quite a while that night. She was sympathetic about everything and told me she'd help me with my papers if I wanted to meet her after school the next night. I knew where her school was. She went to the same school as Van. And it was all the way over in the East Bay,
where I hadn't visited since the bombs went. I was really excited at the prospect of seeing her again. Every night since the party, I'd gone to bed thinking of two things: the sight of the crowd charging the police lines, and the feeling of the side of her breast under her shirt as we leaned against the pillar. She was amazing. I'd never been with a girl as aggressive as her before. It had always been me putting the moves on and them pushing me away. I got the feeling that Ange was as much of a horn dog as I was. It was a tantalizing notion. I slept soundly that night, with exciting dreams of me and Ange and what we might do if we found ourselves in a secluded spot somewhere. The next day, I set out to work on my papers. San Francisco is a good place to write about. History? Sure, it's there, from the Gold Rush to the World War II shipyards, the Japanese internment camps, the invention of the PC. Physics? The Exploratorium has the coolest exhibits of any museum I've ever been to. I took a perverse satisfaction in the exhibits on soil liquefaction during big quakes. English? Jack London, beat poets, science fiction writers like Pat Murphy and Rudy Rucker. Social studies? The free speech movement. Cesar Chavez, gay rights, feminism, the anti-war movement. I've always loved just learning stuff for its own sake, just to be smarter about the world around me. I could do that just by walking around the city. I decided I'd do an English paper about the Beats first. City Lights Books had a great library in an upstairs room where Allen Ginsberg and his buddies had created their radical, druggy poetry. The one we read in English class was Howl, and I would never forget the opening lines. They gave me shivers down my back. I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving hysterical naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn looking for an angry fix, angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo and the machinery of night. I liked the way he ran those words all together, starving hysterical naked. I knew how that felt. And best minds of my generation made me think hard, too. It made me remember the park and the police and the gas falling. They busted Ginsberg for obscenity over Howl, all about a line about gay sex that would hardly have caused us to blink an eye today. It made me happy somehow, knowing that we'd made some progress, that things had been even more restrictive than this before. I lost myself in the library, reading these beautiful old editions of the books. I got lost in Jack Kerouac's On the Road, a novel I'd been meaning to read for a long time, and a clerk who came up to check on me nodded approvingly and found me a cheap edition that he sold me for $6. I walked into Chinatown and had dim sum buns and noodles with hot sauce that I had previously considered to be pretty hot, but which would never seem anything like hot ever again, not now that I'd had an Ange special. As the day wore on toward afternoon, I got on the BART and switched to a San Mateo Bridge shuttle bus to bring me around to the East Bay. I read my copy of On the Road and dug the scenery whizzing past. On the Road is a semi-autobiographical novel about Jack Kerouac, a druggy, hard-drinking writer who goes hitchhiking around America, working crummy jobs, howling through the streets at night, meeting people and parting ways. Hipsters, sad-faced hobos, con men, muggers, scumbags, and angels. There's not really a plot. Kerouac supposedly wrote it in 3 weeks on a long roll of paper, stoned out of his mind. Only a bunch of amazing things, one thing happening after another. He makes friends with self-destructing people like Dean Moriarty, who get him involved in weird schemes that never really work out, but still it works out, if you know what I mean. There was a rhythm to the words. It was luscious. I could hear it being read aloud in my head. It made me want to lie down in the bed of a pickup truck and wake up in a dusty little town somewhere in the Central Valley on the way to L.A., one of those places with a gas station and a diner, and just walk out into the fields and meet people and see stuff and do stuff. It was a long bus ride, and I must have dozed off a little. Staying up late IMing with Ange was hard on my sleep schedule, since Mom still expected me down for breakfast. I woke up and changed buses, and before long, I was at Ange's school. She came bounding out of the gates in her uniform. I'd never seen her in it before. It was kind of cute in a weird way, and reminded me of Van in her uniform. She gave me a long hug and a hard kiss on the cheek. "Hello, you," she said. "Hiya. What you reading?" I'd been waiting for this. I'd marked the passage with a finger. "Listen." They danced down the streets like dingle dotties, and I shambled after as I've been doing all my life after people who interest me, because the only people for me are the mad ones, the ones who are mad to live, mad to talk, mad to be saved, desirous of everything at the same time, the ones that never yawn or say a commonplace thing, but burn, burn, burn like fabulous yellow Roman candles, exploding like spiders across the stars, and in the middle you see the blue center light pop, and everybody goes, "Ah!" She took the book and read the passage again for herself. "Wow! Dingle dotties! I love it! Is it all like this?" I told her about the parts I'd read, walking slowly down the sidewalk back toward the bus stop. Once we turned the corner, she put her arm around my waist, and I slung mine around her shoulder. Walking down the street with the girl, my girlfriend? Sure. Why not? Talking about this cool book. It was heaven. Made me forget my troubles for a little while. "Marcus?" I turned around. It was Van. In my subconscious, I'd expected this. I knew because my conscious mind wasn't remotely surprised. It wasn't a big school, and they all got out at the same time. I hadn't spoken to Van in weeks, and those weeks felt like months. We used to talk every day. "Hey, Van," I said. I suppressed the urge to take my arm off of Ange's shoulders. Van seemed surprised, but not angry. More ashen, shaken. She looked closely at the two of us. "Angela?"
"Hey, Vanessa," Ange said.
"What are you doing here?" Van asked me. "I came out to get Ange," I said, trying to keep my tone neutral. I was suddenly embarrassed to be seen with another girl.
"Oh," Van said. "Well, it was nice to see you."
"Nice to see you too, Vanessa," Ange said, swinging me around, marching me back toward the bus stop.
"You know her?" Ange said.
"Yeah, since forever."
"Was she your girlfriend?"
"What? No, no way. We were just friends."
"You were friends?"
I felt like Van was walking right behind us, listening in, though at the pace we were walking, she would have to be jogging to keep up. I resisted the temptation to look over my shoulder for as long as possible. Then I did. There were lots of girls from the school behind us, but no Van. She was with me and Jose Luis and Daryl when we were arrested. We used to arg together, the four of us. We were kind of best friends.
"And what happened?"
I dropped my voice. "She didn't like the X-Net," I said. "She thought we would get into trouble, that I'd get other people into trouble."
"And that's why you stopped being friends?"
"We just drifted apart."
We walked a few steps.
"You weren't, you know, boyfriend-girlfriend friends?"
"No," I said. My face was hot. I felt like I sounded like I was lying, even though I was telling the truth. Ange jerked us to a halt and studied my face.
"Were you?"
"No, seriously. Just friends. Daryl and her, well, not quite, but Daryl was so into her. There was no way.
But if Daryl hadn't been into her, you would have, huh?"
No, Ange, no. Please, just believe me and let it go. Vanessa was a good friend, and we're not anymore. And that upsets me, but I was never into her that way. All right?
She slumped a little.
Okay, okay, I'm sorry. I don't really get along with her, is all. We've never gotten along in all the years we've known each other.
Oh-ho, I thought. This would be how it came to be that Holu knew her for so long and I never met her. She had some kind of thing with Van, and he didn't want to bring her around. She gave me a long hug, and we kissed. And a bunch of girls passed us going, "Woo!" And we straightened up and headed for the bus stop. Ahead of us walked Van, who must have gone past while we were kissing. I felt like a complete jerk. Of course, she was at the stop and on the bus, and we didn't say a word to each other. And I tried to make conversation with Ange all the way, but it was awkward. The plan was to stop for a coffee and head to Ange's place to hang out and study, i.e., take turns on her Xbox looking at the X-Net. Ange's mom got home late on Tuesdays, which was her night for yoga class and dinner with her girls, and Ange's sister was going out with her boyfriend, so we'd have the place to ourselves. I'd been having pervy thoughts about it ever since we'd made the plan. We got to her place and went straight to her room and shut the door. Her room was kind of a disaster, covered with layers of clothes and notebooks and parts of PCs that would dig into your stocking feet like caltrops. Her desk was worse than the floor, piled high with books and comics, so we ended up sitting on her bed, which was okay by me. The awkwardness from seeing Van had gone away somewhat, and we got her Xbox up and running. It was in the center of a nest of wires, some going to a wireless antenna she'd hacked into it and stuck to the window so she could tune in the neighbor's Wi-Fi. Some went to a couple of old laptop screens she'd turned into standalone monitors, balanced on stands and bristling with exposed electronics. The screens were on both bedside tables, which was an excellent setup for watching movies or IMing from bed. She could turn the monitor sideways and lie on her side, and they'd be right side up, no matter which side she lay on. We both knew what we were really there for, sitting side by side, propped against the bedside table. I was trembling a little, and super conscious of the warmth of her leg and shoulder against mine. But I needed to go through the motions of logging into XNet and seeing what email I'd gotten and so on. There was an email from a kid who liked to send in funny phone cam videos of the DHS being really crazy. The last one had been of them disassembling a baby stroller after a bomb-sniffing dog had shown an interest in it, taking it apart with screwdrivers right on the street in the marina while all these rich people walked past, staring at them and marveling at how weird it was. I'd linked to the video and it had been downloaded like crazy. He'd hosted it on the Internet Archive's Alexandria Mirror in Egypt, where they'd host anything for free so long as you'd put it under the Creative Commons license, which let anyone remix it and share it. The U.S. Archive, which was down in the Presidio, only a few minutes away, had been forced to take down all those videos in the name of national security. But the Alexandria Archive had split away into its own organization and was hosting anything that embarrassed the USA. This kid, his handle was Camera Spy, had sent me an even better video this time around. It was at the doorway to City Hall and Civic Center, a huge wedding cake of a building covered with statues and little archways and gilt leaves and trim. The DHS had a secure perimeter around the building, and Camera Spy's video showed a great shot of their checkpoint as a guy in an officer's uniform approached and showed his ID and put his briefcase on the X-ray belt. It was all okay until one of the DHS people saw something he didn't like on the X-ray. He questioned the general, who rolled his eyes and said something inaudible. The video had been shot from across the street, apparently with a homemade concealed zoom lens, so the audio was mostly of people walking past and traffic noises. The general and the DHS guy got into an argument, and the longer they argued, the more DHS guys gathered around them. Finally, the general shook his head angrily and waved his finger at the DHS guy's chest and picked up his briefcase and started to walk away. The DHS guys shouted at him, but he didn't slow. His body language really said, "I am totally, utterly pissed." Then it happened. The DHS guys ran after the general. Camera spy slowed the video down here so we could see, in frame-by-frame slow-mo, the general half-turning, his face all like, "No freaking way are you about to tackle me." Then changing to horror as three of the giant DHS guards slammed into him, knocking him sideways, then catching him at the middle like a career-ending football tackle. The general, middle-aged, steely gray hair, lined and dignified face, went down like a sack of potatoes and bounced twice, his face slamming off the sidewalk and blood starting out of his nose. The DHS hog-tied the general, strapping him at the ankles and wrists. The general was shouting now, really shouting, his face purpling under the blood streaming from his nose. Legs swished by in the tight zoom. Passing pedestrians looked at this guy in his uniform getting tied up, and you could see from his face that this was the worst part. This was the ritual humiliation, the removal of dignity. The clip ended. "Oh, my dear sweet Buddha," I said, looking at the screen as it faded to black, starting the video again. I nudged Ange and showed her the clip. She watched wordless, jaw hanging down to her chest. "Post that," she said. "Post that, post that, post that, post that." I posted it. I could barely type as I wrote it up, describing what I'd seen, adding a note to see if anyone could identify the military man in the video, if anyone knew anything about this. I hit publish. We watched the video. We watched it again. My email pinged. "I totally recognize that dude. You can find his bio on Wikipedia. He's General Claude Geist. He commanded the joint UN peacekeeping mission in Haiti." I checked the bio. There was a picture of the general at a press conference and notes about his role in the difficult Haiti mission. It was clearly the same guy. I updated the post. Theoretically, this was Ange's and my chance to make out, but that wasn't what we ended up doing. We crawled the XNet blogs, looking for more accounts of the DHS searching people, tackling people, invading them. This was a familiar task, the same thing I'd done with all the footage and accounts from the riots in the park. I started a new category on my blog for this, abuses of authority, and filed them away. Ange kept coming up with new search terms for me to try, and by the time her mom got home, my new category had 70 posts, headlined by General Geist's City Hall takedown. I worked on my beat paper all the next day at home, reading Kerouac and surfing the XNet. I was planning on meeting Ange at school, but I totally wimped out at the thought of seeing Van again, so I texted her an excuse about working on the paper. There were all kinds of great suggestions for abuses of authority coming in, hundreds of little and big ones, pictures and audio. The meme was spreading. It spread. The next morning, there were even more. Someone started a new blog, also called Abuses of Authority, that collected hundreds more. The pile grew. We competed to find the juiciest stories, the craziest pictures. The deal with my parents was that I'd eat breakfast with them every morning and talk about the projects I was doing. They liked that I was reading Kerouac. It had been a favorite book of both of theirs, and it turned out there was already a copy on the bookcase in my parents' room. My dad brought it down, and I flipped through it. There were passages marked up with pen, dog-eared pages, notes in the margin. My dad had really loved this book. It made me remember a better time, when my dad and I had been able to talk for 5 minutes without shouting at each other about terrorism, and we had a great breakfast, talking about the way that the novel was plotted, all the crazy adventures. But the next morning at breakfast, they were both glued to the radio.
Abuses of authority. It's the latest craze on San Francisco's notorious X-Net, and it's captured the world's attention. Called AOA, the movement is composed of little brothers who watch back against the Department of Homeland Security's anti-terrorism measures, documenting the failures and excesses. The rallying cry is a popular viral video clip of a General Claude Geist, a retired three-star general, being tackled by DHS officers on the sidewalk in front of City Hall. Geist hasn't made a statement on the incident, but commentary from young people who are upset with their own treatment has been fast and furious. Most notable has been the global attention the movement has received. Stills from the Geist video have appeared on the front pages of newspapers in Korea, Great Britain, Germany, Egypt, and Japan. And broadcasters around the world have aired the clip on primetime news. The issue came to a head last night when the British Broadcasting Corporation's National News Evening program ran a special report on the fact that no American broadcaster or news agency has covered this story. Commenters on the BBC's website noted that BBC America's version of the news did not carry the report. They brought on a couple of interviews. British media watchdogs, a Swedish pirate party kid who made jeering remarks about America's corrupt press, a retired American newscaster living in Tokyo. Then they aired a short clip from Al Jazeera, comparing the American press record and the record of the national news media in Syria. I felt like my parents were staring at me, that they knew what I was doing. But when I cleared away my dishes, I saw that they were looking at each other. Dad was holding his coffee cup so hard his hands were shaking. Mom was looking at him.
"They're trying to discredit us," Dad said finally. "They're trying to sabotage the efforts to keep us safe."
I opened my mouth, but my mom caught my eye and shook her head. Instead, I went up to my room and worked on my Kerouac paper. Once I'd heard the door slam twice, I fired up my Xbox and got online.
"Hello, Mikey. This is Colin Brown. I'm a producer with the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation's news program, The National. We're doing a story on X-Net and have sent a reporter to San Francisco to cover it from there. Would you be interested in doing an interview to discuss your group and its actions?"
I stared at the screen. Jesus, they wanted to interview me about my group?
Thanks, no. I'm all about privacy, and it's not my group. But thanks for doing the story.
A minute later, another email.
"We can mask you and ensure your anonymity. You know that the Department of Homeland Security will be happy to provide their own spokesperson. I'm interested in getting your side." I filed the email. He was right, but I'd be crazy to do this. For all I knew, he was the DHS. I picked up more Kerouac. Another email came in. Same request, different news agency. KQED wanted to meet me and record a radio interview. A station in Brazil. The Australian Broadcasting Corporation. Deutsche Welle. All day the press requests came in. All day, I politely turned them down. I didn't get much Kerouac read that day.
"Hold a press conference," is what Ange said as we sat in the cafe near her place that evening. I wasn't keen on going out to her school anymore, getting stuck on a bus with Van again.
"What? Are you crazy?"
"Do it in Clockwork Plunder. Just pick a trading post where there's no PvP allowed and name a time. You can log in from here."
PvP is player versus player combat. Parts of Clockwork Plunder were neutral ground, which meant that we could theoretically bring in a ton of noob reporters without worrying about gamers killing them in the middle of the press conference.
"I don't know anything about press conferences."
"Oh, just Google it. I'm sure someone's written an article on holding a successful one.
I mean, if the president can manage it, I'm sure you can. He looks like he can barely tie his shoes without help.
We ordered more coffee.
You are a very smart woman, I said. And I'm beautiful, she said.
That too, I said. Chapter 15. I'd blogged the press conference even before I'd sent out the invitations to the press. I could tell that all these writers wanted to make me into a leader, or a general, or a supreme guerrilla commandant, and I figured one way of solving that would be to have a bunch of ex-netters running around answering questions too. Then I emailed the press. The responses ranged from puzzled to enthusiastic. Only the Fox reporter was outraged that I had the gall to ask her to play a game in order to appear on her TV show. The rest of them seemed to think that it would make a pretty cool story, though plenty of them wanted lots of tech support for signing on to the game. I picked 8 p.m., after dinner. Mom had been bugging me about all the evenings I'd been spending out of the house, until I finally spilled the beans about Ange, whereupon she came over all misty and kept looking at me like my little boy's growing up. She wanted to meet Ange, and I used that as leverage, promising to bring her over the next night if I could go to the movies with Ange tonight. Ange's mom and sister were out again. They weren't real stay-at-homes, which left me and Ange alone in her room with her Xbox and mine. I unplugged one of her bedside screens and attached my Xbox to it so that we could both log in at once. Both Xboxes were idle, logged into Clockwork Plunder. I was pacing.
It's going to be fine, she said. She glanced at her screen. Patch Eye Pete's Market has 600 players in it now.
We'd picked Patch Eye Pete's because it was the market closest to the village square where new players spawned. If the reporters weren't already Clockwork Plunder players, ha! Then that's where they'd show up. In my blog post, I'd asked people generally to hang out on the route between Patch Eye Pete's and the spawn gate and direct anyone who looked like a disoriented reporter over to Pete's. What the hell am I going to tell them?
You just answer their questions, and if you don't like a question, ignore it. Someone else can answer it. It'll be fine.
This is insane.
This is perfect, Marcus. If you really want to screw the DHS, you have to embarrass them. It's not like you're going to be able to outshoot them. Your only weapon is your ability to make them look like morons.
I flopped on the bed, and she pulled my head into her lap and stroked my hair. I'd been playing around with different haircuts before the bombing, dyeing it all kinds of funny colors, but since I'd gotten out of jail, I couldn't be bothered. It had gotten long and stupid and shaggy, and I'd gone into the bathroom and grabbed my clippers and buzzed it down to half an inch all around, which took zero effort to take care of and helped me to be invisible when I was out jamming and cloning ARFIDs. I opened my eyes and stared into her big brown eyes behind her glasses. They were round and liquid and expressive. She could make them bug out when she wanted to make me laugh, or make them soft and sad, or lazy and sleepy in a way that made me melt into a puddle of horniness. That's what she was doing right now. I sat up slowly and hugged her. She hugged me back. We kissed. She was an amazing kisser. I know I've already said that, but it bears repeating. We kissed a lot, but for one reason or another, we always stopped before it got too heavy. Now I wanted to go further. I found the hem of her t-shirt and tugged. She put her hands over her head and pulled back a few inches. I knew that she'd do that. I'd known since the night in the park. Maybe that's why we hadn't gone further. I knew I couldn't rely on her to back off, which scared me a little. But I wasn't scared then. The impending press conference, the fights with my parents, the international attention, the sense that there was a movement that was careening around the city like a wild pinball.
It made my skin tingle and my blood sing. And she was beautiful and smart and clever and funny, and I was falling in love with her. Her shirt slid off. She arched her back to help me get it over her shoulders. She reached behind her and did something, and her bra fell away. I stared goggle-eyed, motionless and breathless, and then she grabbed my shirt and pulled it over my head, grabbing me and pulling my bare chest to hers. We rolled on the bed and touched each other and ground our bodies together and groaned. She kissed all over my chest, and I did the same to her. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't think. I could only move and kiss and lick and touch. We dared each other to go forward. I undid her jeans. She undid mine. I lowered her zipper. She did mine and tugged my jeans off. I tugged off hers. A moment later, we were both naked, except for my socks, which I peeled off with my toes. It was then that I caught sight of the bedside clock, which had long ago rolled onto the floor and lay there, glowing up at us.
"Crap!" I yelled. "It starts in 2 minutes!" I couldn't freaking believe that I was about to stop what I was about to stop doing when I was about to stop doing it. I mean, if you'd asked me, "Marcus, you're about to get laid for the firstest time ever. Will you stop if I let off this nuclear bomb in the same room as you?" The answer would have been a resounding and unequivocal no. And yet, we stopped for this. She grabbed me and pulled my face to hers and kissed me until I thought I would pass out. Then we both grabbed our clothes and more or less dressed, grabbing our keyboards and mice and heading for Patch Eye Pete's. You could easily tell who the press were. They were the noobs who played their characters like staggering drunks, weaving back and forth and up and down, trying to get the hang of it all, occasionally hitting the wrong key and offering strangers all or part of their inventory, or giving them accidental hugs and kicks. The X-Netters were easy to spot, too. We all played Clockwork Plunder whenever we had some spare time, or didn't feel like doing our homework, and we had pretty tricked-out characters with cool weapons and booby traps on the keys sticking out of our backs that would cream anyone who tried to snatch them and leave us to wind down. When I appeared, a system status message displayed, "Mikey has entered Patch Eye Pete's. Welcome, Swabby. We offer fair trade for fine booty." All the players on the screen froze. Then they crowded around me. The chat exploded. I thought about turning on my voice paging and grabbing a headset, but seeing how many people were trying to talk at once, I realized how confusing that would be. Text was much easier to follow, and they couldn't misquote me. I'd scouted the location before with Ange. It was great campaigning with her, since we could both keep each other wound up. There was a high spot on a pile of boxes of salt rations that I could stand on and be seen from anywhere in the market. "Good evening, and thank you all for coming. My name is Mikey, and I'm not the leader of anything. All around you are X-Netters who have as much to say about why we're here as I do. I use the X-Net because I believe in freedom and the Constitution of the United States of America. I use X-Net because the DHS has turned my city into a police state where we're all suspected terrorists. I use X-Net because I think you can't defend freedom by tearing up the Bill of Rights. I learned about the Constitution in a California school, and I was raised to love my country for its freedom. If I have a philosophy, it is this. Governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness.
I didn't write that, but I believe it. The DHS does not govern with my consent. Thank you. I'd written this the day before, bouncing drafts back and forth with Ange. Pasting it in only took a second, though it took everyone in the game a moment to read it. A lot of the ex-netters cheered, big showy pirate hurrahs with raised sabers and pet parrots squawking and flying overhead. Gradually, the journalists digested it too. The chat was running past fast, so fast you could barely read it. Lots of ex-netters saying things like, "Right on," and "America, love it or leave it," and "DHS, go home," and "America, out of San Francisco," all slogans that had been big on the ex-net blogosphere. "Mikey, this is Priya Rajneesh from the BBC. You say you're not the leader of any movement. But do you believe there is a movement? Is it called the X-Net?" Lots of answers. Some people said there wasn't a movement. Some said there was, and lots of people had ideas about what it was called. X-Net, Little Brothers, Little Sisters, and my personal favorite, the United States of America. They were really cooking. I let them go, thinking of what I could say. Once I had it, I typed. "I think that kind of answers your question, doesn't it? There may be one or more movements, and they may be called X-Net or not. Mikey, I'm Doug Christensen from the Washington Internet Daily. What do you think the DHS should be doing to prevent another attack on San Francisco, if what they're doing isn't successful?" More chatter. Lots of people said that the terrorists and the government were the same. Either literally or just meaning that they were equally bad. Some said the government knew how to catch terrorists but preferred not to because war presidents got reelected. "I don't know," I typed finally. "I really don't. I ask myself this question a lot because I don't want to get blown up and I don't want my city to get blown up. Here's what I've figured out, though. If it's the DHS's job to keep us safe, they're failing. All the crap they've done, none of it would stop the bridge from being blown up again. Tracing us around the city, taking away our freedom, making us suspicious of each other, turning us against each other, calling dissenters traitors. The point of terrorism is to terrify us. The DHS terrifies me. I don't have any say in what the terrorists do to me, but if this is a free country, then I should be able to at least say what my own cops do to me. I should be able to keep them from terrorizing me. I know that's not a good answer. Sorry."
"What do you mean when you say that the DHS wouldn't stop terrorists? How do you know?"
"Who are you?"
"I'm with the Sydney Morning Herald."
"I'm 17 years old. I'm not a straight-A student or anything. Even so, I figured out how to make an internet that they can't wiretap. I figured out how to jam their person-tracking technology. I can turn innocent people into suspects and turn guilty people into innocents in their eyes. I could get metal onto an airplane or beat a no-fly list. I figured this stuff out by looking at the web and by thinking about it. If I can do it, terrorists can do it. They told us they took away our freedom to make us safe. Do you feel safe?"
"In Australia? Why, yes, I do."
The pirates all laughed. More journalists asked questions. Some were sympathetic, some were hostile. When I got tired, I handed my keyboard to Ange and let her be Mikey for a while. It didn't really feel like Mikey and me were the same person anymore anyway. Mikey was the kind of kid who talked to international journalists and inspired a movement. Marcus got suspended from school and fought with his dad and wondered if he was good enough for his kick-ass girlfriend. By 11 p.m., I'd had enough. Besides, my parents would be expecting me home soon. I logged out of the game, and so did Ange, and we lay there for a moment. I took her hand, and she squeezed hard. We hugged. She kissed my neck and murmured something.
"What?"
"I said I love you," she said.
What, you want me to send you a telegram?
Wow, I said. You were that surprised, huh?
No, it's just... I was going to say that to you.
Sure you were, she said, and bit the tip of my nose.
It's just that I've never said it before, I said. So I was working up to it.
You still haven't said it, you know. Don't think I haven't noticed. We girls pick up on these things.
I love you, Ange Carvelli, I said.
I love you too, Marcus Yellow.
We kissed and nuzzled, and I started to breathe hard, and so did she. That's when her mom knocked on the door.
Angela, she said, I think it's time your friend went home, don't you?
Yes, mother,
she said, and mimed swinging an axe. As I put my socks and shoes on, she muttered,
They'll say that Angela, she was such a good girl. Who would have thought it? All the time she was in the backyard helping her mother out by sharpening that hatchet.
I laughed. You don't know how easy you have it. There is no way my folks would leave us alone in my bedroom until 11 o'clock.
11:45,
she said, checking her clock.
Crap, I yelped, and tied my shoes. Go, she said. Run and be free. Look both ways before crossing the road. Ride if you get work. Don't even stop for a hug. If you're not out of here by the count of 10, there's going to be trouble, mister. 1, 2, 3.
I shut her up by leaping onto the bed, landing on her, and kissing her until she stopped trying to count. Satisfied with my victory, I pounded down the stairs, my Xbox under my arm. Her mom was at the foot of the stairs. We'd only met a couple times. She looked like an older, taller version of Ange. Ange said her father was the short one, with contacts instead of glasses. She seemed to have tentatively classed me as a good guy, and I appreciated it. Good night, Mrs. Carvelli, I said.
Good night, Mr. Yellow, she said.
It was one of our little rituals, ever since I'd called her Mrs. Carvelli when we first met. I found myself standing awkwardly by the door.
Yes, she said.
I said, thanks for having me over.
You're always welcome in our home, young man, she said.
And thanks for Ange, I said finally, hating how lame it sounded. But she smiled broadly and gave me a brief hug.
You're very welcome, she said.
The whole bus ride home, I thought over the press conference. Thought about Ange naked and writhing with me on her bed. Thought about her mother smiling and showing me the door. My mom was waiting up for me. She asked me about the movie, and I gave her the response I'd worked out in advance, cribbing from the review it had gotten in the Bay Guardian. As I fell asleep, the press conference came back. I was really proud of it. It had been so cool to have all these big-shot journos show up in the game, to have them listen to me, and to have them listen to all the people who believed in the same things as me. I dropped off with a smile on my lips. I should have known better.